Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club. I'm your chair for the day, although I will be standing. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And in a moment, I'm going to introduce our distinguished panel. We have a great panel, but first I have to remark that listening to that introduction, you're probably expecting me to be ponderous, self-important, condescending, arrogant, and maybe even a little patronizing. But I'm generally able to provide only about 3 out of 5. But I'm going to try to do better this afternoon. We have a marvelous panel here this afternoon to discuss a fascinating yet depressing topic, euphemistically called human trafficking, when in fact it's modern-day slavery. I'll introduce them now, and in a few minutes each of them will tell you a little bit about more about their work, and then we'll open the floor to questions from all of you, written questions. David Batstone is a professor of business at the University of San Francisco. He is also founder and president of Not For Sale, an anti-human trafficking campaign, as well as managing partner of the Just Business Venture Fund. David is widely published in both the academic and the popular press. His 5 books address ethical issues at the crossroads of politics, economy, and spirituality. That's an interesting crossroads. Mimi Chakarova teaches visual storytelling at the University of California's Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. And for the past decade, she has worked as a photographer and filmmaker covering international conflict, corruption, and the sex trade. Her film, The Price of Sex, a feature-length documentary on trafficking and corruption, premiered this spring. And she won the Nestor Almendras Award for Courage in Filmmaking at the 2011 Human Rights Watch Film Festival in New York, and the 2011 Daniel Pearl Award for Outstanding International Investigative Reporting. Dolores Donovan is professor of law at the University of San Francisco's Law School and director of international program development. Her publications deal with the legal systems of developing nations and criminal justice. She is a consultant to foundations and government international development agencies, and she was the Southeast Regional Senior Equity Advisor to the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. Her expertise in this arena is the source areas for the victims of trafficking, especially those in South and Southeast Asia. Well, as it happens, we share that interest, and I'm going to tell you for a few minutes about my own experience in this topic. For me, it began 12 years ago when I invited my brother over to dinner. He worked for the State Department at the time, and he showed up and asked for a bourbon and soda. This is in Washington, D.C., and he plopped a thick envelope on the kitchen counter with the State Department logo in the upper left-hand corner. Inside was a report on human trafficking, an issue I had never heard of before. This is the year 2000. Amy O'Neill Richards, working in a State Department intelligence officer working in a special CIA program, had done this report, and when I read it, I was shocked and also excited. Excited because in journalism, you don't often get to write about a brand new topic, something that most people who read your newspaper don't know anything about, and this was one. So here's what I wrote in April 2000, and as I said, it was shocking to me. As many as 50,000 women and children from Asia, Latin America, and Eastern Europe are brought to the United States under false pretenses each year and forced to work as prostitutes, abused laborers, or servants, according to a central intelligence agency report that is the government's first and only comprehensive assessment of the problem. The carefully annotated and exhaustively researched 79-page report is called International Trafficking in Women to the United States, a Contemporary Manifestation of Slavery. It paints a broad picture of the hidden trade, of the difficulties that the government agencies fight in fighting this problem. Well, I found this appalling and fascinating. Slavery, all of a sudden, born again. Well, it hadn't been born again, but finally the United States noticed it. The modern-day version of it came largely when women in the former Soviet Union found they had no jobs and were lured to other states with promises to be a secretary or something else and trapped in the sex trade. Well, I set off on a full year of research, and my most memorable moment was in Maasai, Thailand, on the western border with Burma. I visited the Daughters Education Program, a special boarding school set up to protect young girls from whose mothers would otherwise sell them into sexual slavery. A teacher told me while I was there that 13-year-old Noi, that was her name, whose mother was just then agitating to sell her for about $75 so she could buy a refrigerator. I talked to Noi and she said, "Sometimes my mother wants to sell me. I feel very sad that my mother would want to do that. I just keep very quiet," and she bowed her head. "I don't dare argue with her. I don't know where she wants me to go." So I waited till school was over and walked home with Noi and asked her mother. It turned out she had already sold both of Noi's older sisters into the sex trade. They were at work in Bangkok, or I think one of them had actually been transported to the United States. When I asked her about selling Noi, she was embarrassed. In fact, she looked shell-shocked. "If I said I might sell her, it was a joke," she said with a guilty grin. Pressed, she went on, "Yes, a person offered Noi a job. I don't know where that person is from. Oh, you have a daughter," he said. "Why doesn't she come work with me?" I wrote about that. I don't know if I intimidated the mother, scared her. I doubt she saw the New York Times there in Maasai, Thailand. But when I went back in 2009, after I'd left the Times and was here at Stanford, I was writing columns. So I went back to the daughter's education school and asked about Noi and met her. Her mother had not sold her. She had been married. She had a job as a teacher. And she had a daughter of her own. In the world we're discussing, modern age slavery, small victories may be the best you can hope for. I don't know whether I scared that woman out of selling her daughter, but I'd like to think that I did. But even that is enough to keep us going, small victories. Well, thank you, and now we're going to turn to our panelists. Mimi.
Thank you very much for being here on such a beautiful day. I wanted to tell you a little bit about The Price of Sex, the documentary that I have worked on for the last 10 years. And can you hear me better now? Okay. And give you more of a sense of the process and what I discovered along the way. This took 7 years of reporting. But the original idea behind making this film was to return to the place where I had grown up, which is a small village in Bulgaria. And my mom and I immigrated to the United States after the collapse of communism in 1990. And when I returned at the age of 15, which was only 2 years after we came to the U.S., I found that many of the girls in this small village had gone to other countries for work, and some of them had not been heard from by their families, which was highly unusual, because people who immigrate tend to stay in touch with their families and also send remittances home, and they support their families back home. So this has been a personal quest for me, to figure out what happened to a lot of these young women. Why were they sold against their will into sexual slavery? How does the system work? And how do you get to know these women? If I knew everything that I know today, and you asked me, would you make a film on the same subject? I have to say no. And I'll explain to you why. No one wants to talk to you about how the sex trade works. The women who have been sold into this are not willing to talk because of three factors: fear, shame, and stigma. Many of them, if they manage to escape, when they return to their communities, if they tell their families what had happened to them, they're often disowned and abused in their own communities. Many of these women are re-trafficked because they feel they have no other choice once they return, because home is no longer home. In some instances, it took me 4 years of knowing a particular woman to get her to agree to speak on camera. This is 4 years of having a relationship, of having trust with the person before I could get her to speak on camera. Now, my motivation has always been to show these women's faces, because I felt that by showing their faces and you as the viewers getting to hear their stories, I'm somehow attacking the stigma in those communities. And that has very much been the case. But you guys, that's just one side of the equation. The supply, which so many of us tend to focus on, and it's a very difficult subject to focus on, which is, where do these women come from? Why do they leave their communities? Under what circumstances do they leave? Who sells them? Who are the traffickers? Who are the people involved? How are they offered these false jobs? And the other question, which as a journalist you have to ask, is this has been going on for more than 20 years now. This has been in the media. This is on bus stops. There is plenty of awareness campaigns throughout Eastern Europe, throughout the Middle East, and so on, and Western Europe as well, which was, I focused on Eastern European women sold into the sex trade, to the Middle East as well as Western Europe. So you have to ask that question, which is, come on, you knew that this existed. This is not news anymore. The answer is consistently the same by every woman I have interviewed through the years. And that answer is, yes, I knew about it, but I didn't think it would happen to me. So you have to understand the level of desperation. A lot of these women are single moms. A lot of them are too young to be called women. And the other thing you have to understand is how global it is. This is not something which is happening in some remote country like Moldova, which is the poorest country in Europe, that many people here have never even heard of, or a place like Transnistria, which is not even recognized by the international community. I was in Oakland just yesterday on International Boulevard, and I saw four young girls pimped out on the street on International Boulevard, teenagers between the ages of 12 and 14. All you have to do is just open your eyes. And the other thing that I tell people when I screen the film, every chance I get to speak about this, is for someone who does investigative journalism, give us 3 days to find you women in any community where we are, and we can find them. What does that tell you about the level of the issue? But let me just say one thing. I know I only have 10 minutes to speak about this. The other side of the equation is even more important to cover, and that's the demand. And that's something that very few people are willing to discuss and truly target. Those who control the women, those who purchase the services, if we want to call them services, of these women, they remain invisible. All you have to do is read the New York Times in the last few days to see what I'm talking about. These people remain invisible, and it's very difficult to track them down. In order for me to do that, I had to pose as a prostitute. I had to go into that dark world to find the people who control the women and get them to speak on camera, because I thought, in order for you to really understand what happens with these women, you have to see where they end up and what their life is like. I'll leave it at this. I'm sure you'll have questions.
Before you go on, we've already got a couple of questions. Where can one purchase The Price of Sex?
You can go to priceofsex.org and contact the distributor of the film, which is Women Make Movies, and all of that information is on the website, as well as a lot of resources and a lot of other helpful information if you want to know more about trafficking.
Thank you. David.
Thank you very much, Mimi. David Batstone, founder with Thank Mark you. Wexler, who's here today, of Not For Sale. I first got involved in this crisis not because I was looking for it, but it found me here in the Bay Area in a restaurant that I frequented on the other side of the Bay, a restaurant that had trafficked hundreds of teenagers from the country of India into the United States for the purpose of forced labor. Joel's right. Human trafficking is a euphemism. It's slavery. It's forced labor. First to work in the restaurant and then put out to fruit and vegetable fields and brothels in Northern California. So as in your own backyard, it raises not only your curiosity, but perhaps more of a motivation to do something about it. So I took a year off, just like Joel, went around the world to investigate how in the world this could happen. Where is it happening? Asked many of the same questions that Mimi just posed. My journey took me to Northern Thailand, where I met a woman who had, outside of Maasai, rescued 27 children, and they were living on a piece of property about 12 miles out of Maasai. No other housing structures, really palm leaf shanties, dirt floors. So I made a commitment to her. Look, I'm a writer. I'm going to write a book about what I'm discovering here, and I'll build a house for you. Came back to San Francisco, teaching at the University of San Francisco, started writing my book, and before I could even get into chapter two, this remarkable woman from Thailand called me and said, you know, there's 27 children, now there's 53. I'm thinking this better be one damn good book. I've got two houses I got to build now. So with new determination, I keep writing. And before I can even finish the book, now it's 88 children in the north of Thailand. So I know I'm not that good of a writer, not like Joel. So I decided to start an agency called Not For Sale, essentially to raise funds to build a village in the north of Thailand. Now to fast forward, that was 5.5, 6 years ago. I just came back last week from a village, 142 children. They're getting shelter. They're going to great schools. First two just graduate, go to university. 45 more going to university in the next 3 years. And that inspired us. But Mark and I started to look at the dynamics of trafficking and said, you know, we could be at the end of a river pulling out the flailing and drowning bodies. That's mercy. That's compassion. And it's hopefully in our DNA as human beings to respond in kind. But at some point, you need to walk upstream. You need to find out why so many bodies are falling in and why they're flailing. And that's justice. Those are systemic issues of justice, and we need to address the issue at that level as well. So I want to give you one model, one example of how Not For Sale works today. You can go to our website, notforsalecampaign.org, where it's fairly exhaustive in what we provide. But I just want to give you one slice of what we do. Eastern Europe. Young women particularly, but young boys as well, trafficked into Western European cities like Rome, London, Amsterdam. We set up in the red light district with the Dutch community of activists, a place where these women behind the windows that are sold so brazenly would be able to get health services, social services, nutritious meals. Through that work, through that compassion work, if you want to call it that, we're gathering data. We discover that 3 out of 4 women behind the windows in this legalized service industry are coming from 3 countries, Bulgaria, Hungary, Romania. In fact, there's one alleyway in Amsterdam that's named after a small town in Hungary from where most of the young girls come from that district. So out of that, we begin to understand more data. The problem with most social movements, they're dumb activists. They don't operate out of data. Understanding what the scope of the problem is and how to target resources. So if you're really interested in going upstream and creating real solutions, you got to have good data. From there, we work with social service delivery agents, shelters in Romania. And we begin to see that most of these young women are Roma or Gypsy, if you will. They come from economically desperate communities, making choices that maybe are not good choices, but choices that to them seem narrow, not a broad range of choices. We see the coincidence between a lack of economic sustainability and the lack of access to public justice. That is, if you're a poor woman, a judge or someone with a uniform on will not give you respect. They will exploit you. You're poor, there is no justice. So we begin to develop a sustainable economic project in that area, that region, that might give jobs and more economic stability. We get 6 greenhouses and we start growing organic vegetables. There's a market for organic vegetables in Western Europe particularly. We scale it to a pilot project. Then Google and Heineken hear about what we're doing. They're very interested in investing more. Well, there's only so far we can scale one experimental farm of organic vegetables in Eastern Romania. So we bridge our relationship with a retailer of 650 stores. It's like a Trader Joe's of Western Europe called HEMA. HEMA promises to buy all of our fruits and vegetables that we can grow in Eastern Europe. We only have $1,500 a month worth of vegetables and fruits in our 6 greenhouses. They said, that's like a garden plot. I said, I know, but if you make that commitment, see, if you make the commitment of demand, then we can go back and find supply. We go to 1,000 farmers, a family association of farmers who are trying to create a market. We go to them and say, look, on 2 principles, if you agree to these, we will sell all your produce. One is that you follow the principles of what we call free to work, and I can go through that later if you'd like. That is, all people are free to work. Unfortunately, they're often exploited and not. The second is you have to hire survivors or people in highly vulnerable communities. And we even target the resources from where we find these young girls in Amsterdam are coming from. That's an example of the model. In October of 2012, we'll launch a product line of goods in HEMA, the Target or the Trader Joe's of Western Europe, a line of products that are branded as not for sale. The people who made these are not for sale. All right, that gives you an example of what we're trying to do.
Thank you. Dolores.
All right. First of all, let me say that I'm trained as a lawyer, and I teach law, so that I tend to approach all problems, including the one of human trafficking, in terms of what laws are needed to get rid of the problem to the extent possible. So that's how I think. With that background, I came to the trafficking pathology as in 2003 when I took a sabbatical and an unpaid leave, actually, and worked for the U.S. Agency for International Development in New Delhi, India, running their regional anti-trafficking programs in India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Nepal. And I also interfaced a great deal with Thailand and Cambodia, or we interfaced a great deal with Thailand and Cambodia, part of the world with which I had previously become very familiar. And my experiences in South Asia and Southeast Asia have formed my view of trafficking, because those are all what are called sending countries. Their populations become victims. They're sent abroad to become victims. And this is the thesis, and that is that human trafficking is a pathological subset of the global phenomenon of labor migration. The girls who end up as victims of trafficking, and the young men and the boys and the women, they're very gutsy young ladies. They're willing to take a chance to improve their lot in life. Not all of them are sold by their parents. Many of them are autonomous actors trying to avoid a very bleak future as an unmarried woman in a desperately poor rural village because their parents cannot afford their dowry. So almost anything they think is better. So then what happens? A labor agent shows up in the village, and usually he's a fraudulent labor agent, and it can be a woman as well, and says, well, I can get you, or I can get your daughter, a job, a good job in the city, working in a hotel, in a big hotel, as a chambermaid or as a waitress, maybe in a home, in someone's home, as a nanny or a domestic servant. Sometimes, unfortunately, these labor agents even say, well, I'll marry your daughter and I'll take her there and we'll find a future together. And so the young women and the girls, the parents, they say, all right, anything is better than leaving my daughter or myself here in this village in the middle of nowhere with absolutely no future. So these, looked at from this perspective, they are traditional migrants. They're the best of people. They are the people who are persecuted or who are unsatisfied with the conditions of their life and who have the guts and the determination to take a chance, to look for a better world. But it goes wrong. Something goes wrong. The chance never materializes. Their lives are, generally speaking, ruined. Certainly they're ruined if they're in a brothel, ruined irreparably. Then if they're put into a forced labor situation, they're very likely to spend the rest of their lives in that situation because those situations are extremely difficult to escape from. And the child laborers, of course, are deprived of education, can never, manage to better themselves in the world. So then, you know, I think, well, what can we do to stop this, to intervene? You know, what is the tipping point? Where's our window of opportunity to step into this vicious path? It's not really a cycle, this vicious, migration, this labor migration. And my answer, which is based on something that a UN rapporteur on violence against women, Radhika Kumaraswamy, a Sri Lankan, said in about 2000, she said, well, traffickers fish in the stream of migration. You know, so to use David's analogy, it's a stream. When I go upstream I find the need for labor regulation. Mm-hmm. That's what we need to be focusing our efforts on, is labor regulation. Making it, and that hits not just, it hits demand, because we're making it difficult, or not impossible, but we're making it difficult for the exploiters to exploit. We're making it hard to run a sweatshop. We're making it difficult to run Foxconn, where Apple products are being made in Taiwan and China. And then we get into the very controversial field of, should we regulate the sex industry as opposed to just shutting it down, which is a real hot potato. But I offer you this other perspective on trafficking, that these are wonderful people. They're the kind of people who we would like to have as citizens in our country, if only their own countries would like to have them as citizens, if only the proper conditions could be set up to maximize their potential rather than to cut it off at its inception. Okay.
Thank you. Let me ask a couple of questions before we turn to the audience. We have lots of interesting questions here. Each of us in our own way, as a journalist, as activists, as academics, have tried to bring awareness to this and raise and bring change. Does anybody have the ability to bring anything more than incremental change, do you believe?
No. I think that your success with NOI is a great success, and hopefully some of the things that I did in South Asia have changed the lives of some young women. But it's you say incremental change, and incremental change over a long period of time can become massive. But so I say yes, only incremental change is possible. But if we persevere, I think that in the end we can have a significant change.
I think if we follow old models of philanthropy, charity, and aid, no. But I think we need to reinvent them in order to engage centers of economic power, which are corporations, if we engage legislations that would coordinate with the deployment of capital in ways that actually then ensure that the benefits of that capital deployment are going to benefit the people who are most vulnerable rather than the people who tend to manipulate capital in most countries around the world. So I think it just requires we call it philanthropy 3.8. It's not moving from 1.0 to 2.0. It's reinventing philanthropy. In fact, we're so brazen to say charity is dead. Invest in the future. And it really requires you to rethink what philanthropy and aid means. I'm a Tigger and not an Eeyore, but I do believe that we can make significant changes, but it requires us to really be bold in our aspirations and include companies like Google, Juniper. Look how successful they've reinvented economy. Well, what would it mean to reinvent social economy?
You know, I agree. I think 5 months ago I received a phone call from the State Department here in the United States, and they asked me, could we use the price of sex as a training tool in embassies throughout the world to educate our staff about this issue, which to me is one very, very small step, but it's an important step because it also acknowledges that people need to be trained properly. People need to get credible information about how the system works. And the second thing, which a lot of people I speak with say, is that the way to end this is to educate people. It's very much the case. But let me tell you this. If I take my film to every single village, let's say in Eastern Europe, and show it to kids and tell them exactly how this works, do you think they're not going to leave? Yes, they will, because they don't have the economic opportunity in their villages, in their towns, which goes back to what David was explaining. I completely agree with this. Education is not enough. You need to also present people with the opportunity to stay in the places where they live or offer migration that is safe.
Actually, I'd like to make one comment here. I covered the State Department for a number of years and actually on this issue. And the State Department publishes a report every year. Every embassy is required, along with human rights and religion, they're supposed to publish a report on human trafficking. But the truth is that if you want to advance in the State Department, this is not the issue you want to focus on. It doesn't bring you much credit. It doesn't help you become an ambassador. It's not a central issue, even though they're forced to write the report. So it's sort of relegated to the side. And that's an unfortunate fact, but it's true. Now, we have a number of questions from the audience, so I think I should turn to those. And a couple of them were the question, I'll read one of them if I can find it, about Islam. Is this primarily a problem of in Islamic countries?
No. In fact, many people would say that there is less of a trafficking problem in terms of Islamic women being trafficked. Now, Mimi might want to talk about, you know, non-Islamic women being trafficked into Islamic countries. But, for example, well, I'll let you talk now.
You know, the three countries, I traveled to 9 different countries in the investigation that you see in The Price of Sex. The three countries, destination countries that I focused on were Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, particularly Dubai, and Greece. Now, a lot of people ask me, why did you pick 2 countries that are Muslim? I did not pick those 2 countries. The women that I met along the way happened to be trafficked to those places. In fact, most women from Moldova, Bulgaria, Romania, and other Eastern European countries end up being sold in Turkey as well as the UAE for sex. But the interesting thing for me is that when people watch the film, they always forget that Greece is another country that I'm profiling. Somehow they focus on the 2 Muslim countries, but they forget Greece. As well as you can add England, you can add Italy. I'll give you this. The 5 top destination countries for women from Eastern Europe in no particular order are Russia, Italy, Greece, Turkey, UAE, and I'm going to add one more, which is Israel. So that's six. So this gives you an idea. And now you can talk about here in the United States, the three states where women, foreign women, are trafficked into the most are California, Texas, and New York, and Florida. I'll add another one. So you have to do your research, and you have to understand that every research, every element is just one piece of the equation, but always keep in mind this is global.
First, I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to a program on human trafficking, and I am the moderator, Joel Brinkley. And so now we'll go on to another question. A couple of people ask, what is the extent of the problem in the Bay Area?
Well, and, you know, since we have a short time in our listening audience over the airwaves, could research this. We created a tool, again, with our friends in Silicon Valley, called slaverymap.org. Slaverymap.org, which identifies cases that have been certified in a fashion, either by court system or certified shelters. And down to a street, you can see in your backyard, whether you're in Walnut Creek today, whether you're in downtown San Francisco, Oakland, or in other regions in the South Bay, that there are trafficking cases. You can see where the victims come from. We usually will cover the name, protect the quote victim, but they are able to see where the traffickers are from, what kind of trafficking, was it labor trafficking, sex trafficking, or some variation thereof. So that research is available, and you can see the quick answer is very prolific in the San Francisco Bay Area. In fact, unfortunately, if you were to take a national average again, California, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, Fresno, are areas of high incidence of trafficking.
One case I investigated years ago was restaurant owner who invited people. He was Indian and invited people from India here and enslaved them and abused them himself, as did his sons in any case. There are a number of questions about why it is that law enforcement does not seem to be focusing on this or doing much of a job in looking at it.
So, the lawyer, right. It's a hard crime to prosecute. First, very obviously, the victims are afraid to testify for fear of retaliation. So then you can get into a long discussion about why don't we provide more adequate measures to keep them safe. Second, the nature of the crime requires often circumstantial proof, especially if the higher up you go in the chain. You know, it's like a conspiracy. And the higher up you go in the chain, the more difficult it is to get the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that will convict someone who's quite high up. It's pretty easy to convict someone at the bottom, but that doesn't do much good. And then third, and especially in South Asia and Southeast Asia, which are the parts of the world that I know, so maybe I shouldn't say especially, but I know those places, corruption is a very big problem. The police officers are often paid off by the traffickers or the brothel madams. Often it's alleged that politicians, are also involved. And I don't want to get into the details, but, you know, I could. So those are three answers as to why prosecution is not very effective. And Joel and I talked before we came, and there's a fourth, which is, you know, some prosecution of crimes is trendy. The police sometimes, there, you know, becomes, there's a big public outcry about drugs, and you get a lot of drug prosecutions. There's a big public outcry about prostitution. You get a lot of prostitution prosecutions. Then there was a big public outcry at the beginning of the decade about trafficking, and a lot of attention was devoted to that subject, but it's kind of falling off of the, you know, out of public attention at this point.
I just want to add lack of proper training and also emphasize corruption. Many of the women I've interviewed who managed to escape a brothel or a sex club tell me that, you know, she would get to a police station, and entering the police station, she would recognize some of the same men who were at the brothel a couple of weeks prior but not wearing uniforms. And it's those same men who would pick up the phone and call the pimps to come and collect the woman. And in fact, in the documentary, The Price of Sex, I've interviewed cops who are very much involved in trafficking as well as using the services of trafficked women.
Just came back from Asia, met with the President and Congress of a particular Asian country, looking at the strategies it would take to mitigate the kind of trafficking coming out of their country, inside their country. So when I asked what kind of local support from law enforcement and from local political offices we might be able to gain, their answer was, well, not much, because most of them are making money off the girls. Everybody makes money off the traffic victims except for the victims themselves.
Yeah, very true.
There is actually constant debate about which is more profitable to criminals around the world: drug trafficking, arms trafficking, or sex trafficking. Well, obviously you can't trace exactly all the income from any of these, but every once in a while people say that sex trafficking is the most profitable one, but at the present it's generally thought to be arms trafficking. But sex trafficking, I should say, labor trafficking is a huge problem too. It's not just sex trafficking, but it's one of the world's most profitable enterprises for the criminals who run it. Another common question among those we've received: what about the contributors to trafficking on the demand side, i.e. the buyers in most places? Are they penalized?
Yeah, I think most of the buyers are in this room today. We're called consumers. I know we don't think of ourselves that way. We think more that that's a question related to sex trafficking. But it was in my investigation around the world that I discovered that many of the products that I buy every day are related to a supply chain. The production of those products are such that when I put this coat on in the morning, I might be wearing someone's suffering. The shoes I'm wearing, I'm trotting on people's dreams. And the coffee I drink, that I'm participating in their tragedy. So how do we turn that around? Probably most of you would not know. If I'm buying a Firestone Bridgestone tire, how would you know that there's 21 civil lawsuits in Liberia against them for forced labor? Knowing that, maybe you wouldn't buy that product. So our small contribution to this at Not For Sale is we created a tool that we work with Juniper Networks in the Silicon Valley, and that tool enables you to walk into a store and scan the barcode on a product and then get a grade that you're all familiar with, A, B, C, D, F. If you buy an A product, that the lives of the people who made that product were enhanced. We have 65 factors behind that. Very transparent, the grading. You can look why a Snickers bar gets an F, why a Divine Chocolate gets an A. You can find out for yourself. But also inform your purchasing. So if we change our demand, the supply will change. Same principle applies to the sex industry. But because we talk so much about sex trafficking-related demand, I think we also need to expand that to labor. And therefore, what Professor Donovan is saying, let's change better labor laws. Let's also look at the ways that companies, we reward them for actually creating products that are made that bring good things to life.
You can also talk about how to define demand. Who are the people who are demanding? Most people would say, well, consumers, which is what David has just said, Professor Batstone, and that's true. But, you know, the labor exploiters are also consumers. They're consuming the exploit, you know, the labor of, you know, trafficked people or forced laborers who are not paid adequately, who are not allowed to leave. So if we can eliminate their demand for people that they can exploit, then we're tackling demand as well. And how do we eliminate that demand? We eliminate it through labor regulation, through enforceable and enforced labor regulation. And there's one piece of legislation I'd just like to point out to you that I think is very important. It was just adopted by the International Labor Organization, the ILO, in June of 2011, and it's called the Domestic Workers Convention. And two of it seeks to regulate the workplace of maids and nannies and cooks who live in private homes, which is a huge step forward because that area, the private sphere, has never been regulated. Two of its key provisions are that these workers must be allowed to leave whenever they want. They must be free to go, and that they must receive cash wages. And in most places of the world, domestic laborers are not free to go, and they don't receive cash wages. And if we can change that, it will have not only an impact on labor migration or forced labor, but also on sex trafficking, because so often women who are brought in as domestic workers end up being sexually abused by the men of the family, and then if they're pregnant, they end up out on the streets, or they become a problem, whether they're pregnant or not, or they're viewed as a problem, and they're out on the streets. And the next thing that happens is a pimp finds them, and then they're in a brothel. So it's like a continuum from labor, unregulated labor, down to unregulated sex industry.
And with sex trafficking, there are two countries that criminalize the Johns, the clients, and those two countries are Sweden and Norway. Now, the criticism there has been that it only pushes sex trafficking, deeper underground. However, people from Sweden and Norway would argue, and we've had this discussion with them about men who are coming for sex tourism or men who are seeking sex tourism will not go to Sweden or Norway, which is definitely true. They will go to a place like Amsterdam or countries that have legalized prostitution, for example, Turkey or Germany.
Here's two people have asked this. As the poverty rate increases and educational opportunities decrease in the USA, is there an increase in this issue with U.S. citizens? Does anybody have any idea?
Well, I think Professor Donovan talked about the streams of migration. Where you have people with uncertain civil rights status, where we have people who are economically vulnerable, where we have people with low education opportunities, then you will have the exploitation of injustice. That translates into lots of different types of avenues, including the forced labor or exploitation of labor or human trafficking. So I guess if all those conditions were such, then indeed the consequence will be people will be exploited. It's almost like a E equals MC squared. Where there's injustice, where there's economic deprivation, you will see the lack of political justice or public justice.
Another question. What institutions, if any, support trafficking, either explicitly or implicitly? For example, some governments or industries or hotel chains.
I'll have to
tell you that when I was in Cambodia 2 years ago staying at the Intercontinental Hotel, which is a chain, almost every day when I got in the elevator, a bellhop would follow me in and offer me a woman. Now, he had to do it every day because I never said yes. But go ahead.
Well, that's another point of attack, is the hotel industry or the tourism industry generally, requiring them to distribute anti-trafficking literature, and if it's not possible to require enlisting them in voluntary associations which, take an oath not to allow prostitutes or child prostitutes in the hotels, putting literature in the rooms, so on and so forth. You can also go after the transportation industry by getting them to tighten up their rules and regulations about proper documentation for the people that they transport, not, you know, ensuring that there are no victims of trafficking with improper documentation being brought across international lines. Also making anti-trafficking literature available at borders, either through the government or through NGOs who are helping out. I know this is done on the border between Nepal and India, which is a major trafficking flow of trafficked women being brought from Nepal into India, and at the borders where there's always huge lines of rickshaws and trucks stopped, the NGOs, in collaboration with the government, patrol. And they hand out literature and they ask suspicious-looking people, you know, to explain themselves. You know, why are you a man with three young women in this vehicle with you? And, you know, get the women to explain what they're doing.
I just want to add that, you know, when I was reporting in Dubai, my hotel room was broken into, and all of my reporting notes and equipment were taken, and I had hidden the video footage, so that survived. But, you know, you have to realize, and I'm also blacklisted from going back to Dubai, so the government is very much involved. They're very much controlling your movement and the type of information that you're trying to expose and bring out. But who are the people, who are the consumers in a place like Dubai where you have 85% of the population foreign-born? Most of them are American and British clients who go there and seek the services of these women.
One more legal input. There are laws that the United States has passed against sex tourism, which unlike many of our criminal laws, are actually quite effective. You can, it's a crime to travel abroad with the intent of having sex with children anywhere in the world. And so if someone is caught, for example, in Cambodia or Thailand or Dubai or whatever, he or she, I guess, could be prosecuted in the United States.
Right. You know, sometimes we forget as U.S. Americans that we have a rule of law that we more or less trust in, I suppose. It's not perfect. In fact, we could all go around the room and give examples where it's not perfect, but we have a certain innate trust in the rule of law because there's a transparency aspect to our behavior, there's an accountability to it, and there's a consequence to it. This does not exist in many places and many cities around the world. So, what would we do in the absence of rule of law or respect of rule of law from those who have been given the uniform or office to exercise that rule of law? We would need to find a transparency and an accountability that would be supplemental or external to the existing system. So if you're in Silicon Valley today, you're at Google, you're at Facebook, what would be those external transparencies? What would be those accountabilities? How would you partner with agencies? And what would that translate into the law enforcement and court systems? This is what the future looks like. But we have to be ahead of it because the traffickers are. Today, a trafficker operates with little degree of fear, impunity, that he or she will go to jail. Who's afraid? Those who are vulnerable. We have to change that equation. If you're listening on the air, I have my hand way up the high. Is no fear, no accountability, and those who are suffering or those who are made victims of that system. We have to change the dynamics of that.
Can we target the governments of these countries and introduce and enforce laws? Now, we've talked about some of those. I'd like to make one comment. As you know, the State Department I mentioned publishes a report on human trafficking in which they rate every country. They also publish reports on drug trafficking, on human rights, religious freedom, and there's discussion of creating one on women. But the problem is they put the trafficking countries in tiers, tier 1, 2, 3, and then the State Department and the administration have the right to penalize the country. But unfortunately, it's subjective, and so in every case, with almost all of these reports, we penalize Iran, we penalize Burma, but now we're not going to do that anymore because they're now a nice country. Sometimes we penalize China, but not very often. Certainly North Korea, but we never penalize our friends. So those reports are just not very effective at all. Would anybody else like to comment on that?
I absolutely agree with you.
I agree, too. But
believe it or not, I might actually think I'd swing your way here. But I do think there's a use for these reports. So I have been in... Now, you're absolutely right. Cuba, of course, terrible trafficker. Is Israel? Clean, no problems, all right? You see the alignment that you're talking about, Joel. But there are countries that are in between. And I'll say something like the Philippines. I just met with the president, and they talked about that report and how do they change that report. And how the justice system there is worried about. So same with Thailand. I met in Thailand. So they're thinking about it is at least something that creates an outside accountability factor. Now, not a very effective one, but it's at least something. So I guess I'm now being a Tiger. When I could be an Eeyore. But I would say, let's not throw it away. Let's just improve more mechanisms like that, as much as I could be cynical. In fact, in my book, you'll see I'm cynical like Joel is about that report. But I think there is some use for it.
Reporting is a standard enforcement technique in international human rights law. The idea is to shame the governments of countries into showing more respect for human rights. And one of the, getting now back to this question about enlisting governments, one of the factors on which ratings are based is whether the countries have enacted adequate anti-trafficking legislation. So that's a push. Another good idea, I think, that it needs to have more attention devoted to it is for sending countries like Bangladesh or Turkey or to have labor attachés in well-known receiving countries such as the top six that Mimi listed, who include in their portfolio monitoring the trafficking situation within that country as it relates to their citizens. And there's lots of very creative ideas as to how to expand on that aspect of governmental involvement.
Where is the United Nations on this issue?
Yeah.
Wow.
The UN has passed the Palermo Protocol in the year 2000, and then it has passed all sorts of optional protocols as well, which outlaw trafficking. That the problem, of course, with all UN legislation is that it's entirely dependent on member countries to adopt it and to enforce it. So the real name of the game is in each individual country. The adoption of the Palermo Protocol, which is something like the Convention Against Trafficking, put the onus on signatory nations to enact their own anti-trafficking legislation. And many of them have, and many of them have not. And many of those who have enacted anti-trafficking legislation don't enforce it and don't implement it. So, again, I think that the rubber hits the roads in the individual countries, in their legislatures, in their police stations, in their prosecutorial corps, as to how seriously they're going to go after traffickers. And here again, let me repeat that I think that trafficking legislation is under-inclusive. It's not a completely adequate response because it, by its very terms, it limits the number, it limits the world of perpetrators that one can access too severely. It leaves untouched a lot of people who are active around the fringes of, core trafficking, who cannot be prosecuted because the legislation does not incorporate them within its reach. And again, I get back to the labor regulation here.
The Palermo Protocol, which was passed in 2000 by the United Nations, was first implemented in 2003. It took 3 years to implement this. And also, let's not forget, during the war in Yugoslavia, in the former Yugoslavia, who were some of the most well-known clients purchasing women, United Nations personnel, who were supposed to protect the population there.
I want to remind you again that you're listening to a Commonwealth Club program on human trafficking and slavery in 2012, and we have time, I believe, for one more question. And it is, what is being done to hold U.S. corporations accountable for forced labor in their supply chains, which I think is a good question.
Well, we're doing our best, and if everyone here listening on KQED or other public radio stations and in the room would download our free-to-work app and actually made purchasing decisions based on those grades and those assessments of supply chain, so that you started buying products that actually, some of the corporations who get A's and B's now are coming to this. This is really interesting global economic dynamics. They said, we can't compete with those who don't monitor, who don't have supply chain systems in place. They're costly. So I'll take the Gap here in San Francisco. Wonderful company. Really, they've been through this cycle. That's really interesting. They're one of our highest grades. That might surprise you. It surprises my students. I'll even tweak them by wearing a Gap shirt. Right? Because some of them will say, man, the Gap, Professor Batson, you're such a hypocrite. You know, sweatshops. They go, no, that was about 20 years ago. That's dumb activism. Smart activism keeps on track with changes in economy. So the Gap is actually a very great company here just down the street, their headquarters. But they can't compete with some of the same brands that these same students buy every day because they don't know about them, because there hasn't been a marketing campaign about X company. So we need better tools that deliver information as you shop, but we got to use them. So it's labor regulation, it's consumer demand. This creates a more costly environment for a company to be able to ignore their supply chain.
I think we are out of time. I want to thank our panelists, thank our audiences here and on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, commemorating 106 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.